The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to Gamban.com to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counsellor with Extra and Problem Gambling. And my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counsellor with the project and the co-author of the book, Tony 10. And today we are delighted to have as our guest the author of a recently released book called Punters, which looks at the rise and rise of Paddy Power and all of their ancillary companies, of which there are many at this stage. And he's also a journalist with the Business Post here in Ireland. Aaron Rogan, thanks a million for joining us today. How are you keeping?
Good.
Let's just start at the start. Why? What possessed you to write a book about Paddy Power?
Well, I've been covering Paddy Power and the gambling industry for about since about 2015. And in doing that, obviously based in Dublin, you know, I got to meet a lot of people or interact with a lot of people who had worked with or rivals of Paddy Power over the years. So I was sort of accumulating these little stories or anecdotes or, you know, just little yarns about how the company had become so big, because it really did just take over gambling in Ireland in the sort of 90s and early 2000s. So I hadn't even, like, which is probably a bit silly as a journalist, I hadn't really considered how they became such a big part, like how this private company became such a big part of Irish life. And I think that's something, speaking to people in the UK, the bits that stand out for them, if they've read the book, or things like Stuart Kenny, the co-founder of Paddy Power, you know, doing political opinion polls on the national radio station. They were like, God, that's crazy. But I never considered it crazy until I stood back and thought about it. And they were just sort of part of the national conversation. So, and growing up in South Dublin, I had a good few friends who worked for them, or people who, you know, friends of friends. And you'd just hear stories about what the company was like, how it used to work out of this little shed in Talla. And just, it was an interesting business story, but I was always very aware of the social issues and the way they targeted people such as Tony with VIP schemes. And I think, you know, I have to give credit to Tony for writing his book and telling his story so openly, because even within the company, that was a big reckoning of, oh, there's something more to this. It isn't just what some of the betting and gaming council called Sunday school prohibitionists, that there's an actual social responsibility that we're neglecting here. And I think it was a good time to do the book as well, because Paddy Power is now Flutter Entertainment and they're about to really just go for broke or really just launch into the US. And this is going to come, it's the exact same things I think are going to happen in terms of social responsibility in the US, and maybe even more so given the Americans, certain states, sort of reluctance to regulate. They think it's sort of, once an industry's in, you let them at it. And, you know, it's up to social responsibility or personal responsibility. So it's just, I thought it was a good time to sort of take a look back at how Paddy Power became this sort of multinational company.
And could you tell us, I mean, some of our listeners, many of our listeners are in Ireland, but some of them are in different parts of the world. And like that, you're talking to people in the UK who can't wrap their heads around Stuart Kenny, you know, doing political polls, or, you know, maybe doing bets on who shot J.R. Ewing back in the day when Dallas was a big thing, maybe kind of struggling to understand that. And we would have listeners in Australia and the US and Canada for whom, you know, having a bookmaker on the street is just not a thing, you know. And actually most of mainland Europe bookmakers, my wife's from Sweden, I live there, there are no bookmakers on the street. You know, it's a thing that's kind of peculiar to Ireland and the UK, that you have bookmakers on the high street. Other parts of the world is not really a thing. So I suppose if you could, just for the sake of the diversity of the listeners that are out there, could you kind of give a boiled down version of where and how Paddy Power started out?
Yeah, so like that with the bookies on the street, there used to be, bookies on every high street and side street in the country, usually located within or between two pubs, ideally. And they were dark and dingy places because they were sort of, they were restricted in what they were allowed in them. They weren't allowed, I think it was called in-site loitering. So, they could only have the racing pages tacked up on the wall. They couldn't have, like for a period, they couldn't have radios because people would obviously congregate to listen. For a period, they couldn't have televisions. But those, without the law being changed, those things just sort of fell away because they just became accepted as normal. And, you know, people took court cases or they challenged the court case, getting them to take their TV out or whatever. So by the sort of mid-80s, some of them were quite, you know, comparatively luxurious places, colourful places, places where, you know, people would be happy enough to spend half an hour on their lunch break or when they're doing the shopping, you know. They became sort of real entertainment hubs. And around that time, there was a cut to the betting tax, which brought the British firms over to Ireland because it became much more profitable to operate here. And it was the Irish bookies who lobbied for that tax, lobbied very aggressively and successfully for it. But it was a lot of their undoings because when the British ones came over, they were big mega chains. So their cost base was much lower. Their profit margins could be a lot tighter. And they just blitzed out the Irish ones. They bought up shops and just completely, you know, just really just offered every promotion, which we've seen recreated now with the online, they're moving to online to get accounts open to attract people. They just did whatever they could. So then three bookies, John Corcoran, Stuart Kenny, and David Power decided to join forces and start an Irish company, Paddy Power. And they started with about 24 shops within the first few months using their own network and buying up some others. And they started to fight back against the British bookies by matching them on offers and sometimes bettering them on offers, by just being a little bit more fun, by appealing to the Irish punter who had a sort of a slightly distinct sensibility compared to the UK one, where they still wanted something of the old independent bookie and it to be your local bookie in the ways you've got a local pub and you prefer one over another, but you're not quite sure why or whatever. So they did that with sort of good customer service, with retaining the local staff, not just bringing in people, and by responding to what people wanted rather than telling them what they wanted. You know, there didn't have to be a board meeting if you wanted to do a particular offer on a particular golf event or whatever. It was the local shop manager said, our customers will want this. We know that the local golf club meets in the pub after a round on Tuesday or Wednesday. Let's promote it in the shop window that day or whatever. And they just really fought back. But in doing that, they really ingrained gambling, I think, into Irish sporting culture in a way it probably hadn't been before, other than obviously horses and greyhounds. And that was the masterstroke of Paddy Power, of being in a country where people were used to bookies and, you know, used to betting, being a part of social life, and then sort of furthering that by taking it away from sport, by offering bets on TV shows or political events or gimmicks, like, you know, doing advertising campaigns about the Pope signing for Glasgow Rangers, which is a, you know, really distinctly sort of Irish type of humor, and, you know, mocking something without openly stating what you're mocking, and doing things like that really brought high street betting into the public consciousness beyond horse and greyhounds, which was, you know, which is really what the industry had been looking to do for a long time.
Yeah, and that's a great part of history. And it's interesting, you know, that was the genesis of Paddy Power, that there was this amalgamation of smaller independent bookmakers to take on, you know, the British are coming. Of course, the irony being that the Irish bookmakers lobbied to reduce the betting tax, which is something that we've had some prior with ourselves in our campaigning over the years, that back in the day, we're going back a while now, was 20% in Ireland, which the punter, the customer paid.
Yeah.
They could either pay it on their winnings, which most people didn't want to do, or they paid it up front on their stake, just for people who are listening. And then the bookies in Ireland lobbied to have that reduced to 10%. Is that when the British bookmakers started coming?
10 when the British came over, and then they got it down to 5, then I think 2.5, and then 1. And, you know, it's worth noting that it wasn't always judiciously collected by bookmakers. There was a lot of I think they call it the penny in the pound scam, where you'd make it look like I had a 5p bet, but I'd actually had a £5 bet. You knew, I knew. And then, you know, there was revenue sort of got involved and said, no, you have to issue real receipts and keep a log of them yourself. And then obviously they said, well, if we're going to have to do that, you're going to have to reduce it because our business model is based on not collecting it. So that was their first real successful lobbying campaign as well, the bookies, because it's sort of worth noting as well that the bookies in Ireland, like the high street bookies, some of them were held in, you know, quite severe contempt by the on-course bookies because they felt people wouldn't go to the races if they could just stay in the pub and listen on the radio. And there was a lot of state money put into developing our horse racing and stud farming sector. So sort of like it was in the national interest to have people going to the races, to sort of bunk off work and go to the races on a summer's day. So they also had to fight that, the high street bookies. And Paddy Power, sort of in power in Corcoran, had a long history in bookmaking, but Stuart Kenny didn't really. He was sort of an upstart, you know, the son of a Supreme Court judge. So he certainly didn't seem to respect the race courses in the same way that other bookies did, and he didn't kowtow to them. And there was a few sort of young bookies who were basically like, you know, this is the future, get used to it, which is sort of another anomaly in Ireland, that, you know, you had to, a lot of political lobbying going on even in the early days of bookmaking.
Yeah, so you have this kind of innovative, iconoclastic type thing going on where they're trying to break the mold of something. I mean, certainly as a kid growing up, I remember I would spend a lot of time in Mullingar where my mother's from, down with my grandparents, and you'd walk through the streets of Mullingar and I was always asking them, what's a turf accountant? Like, well, this thing does not make sense in my head, you know, and they would try to explain to me what it was, and they were just grim, dingy places that little elfillas and Crombie coats went in and out of it occasionally. Utterly depressing, not in the way that they currently are, but in a very different way, just glum, dour, not of any interest, certainly not to a child. And then, yeah, there's this revamp going on where there's this other thing going on, this all this innovation and stuff. And the battle between, okay, the Irish bookmakers, this kind of early stage, Paddy Power, 24 shops, taking on the Ladbrokes and the William Hills and the big UK companies. So there's that battle, and you talk about that in the book, there's that kind of battle for high street space and trying to get the best spots. And obviously Paddy Power were squeezing out a lot of the Irish independents as well. So it's not like they were just the kind friend of Irish independent bookmaking. The British were the enemy. Like, it was, you know, Paddy Power versus the British. Obviously Boyles were in there as well. And then you end up with these kind of superpowers, British and Irish, squeezing out the vast, vast majority of the small independents who either they bought up or put out of business.
And in some cases they do both, you know, they'd buy one up and then when the guy sort of reopened someplace else, they'd chase him around the corner, you know, and open their own shop again and squeeze them out again. And it became quite fractious for a while, but, you know, Paddy Power was unrepentant at the time. Stuart Kenny was unrepentant at the time that this is how you did it. This was, you know, this was business. And there was sort of, you know, businessmen always love referring to things as being like battles and wars. So there was little tax wars where, you know, Ivan Yates, who'd be very familiar to Irish listeners, would offer tax-free betting where he'd pay the tax on your bets. And then Paddy Power would have to do the same. And in the same town, and there'd be some poor independent bookmaker squeezed out because he has to do the same. And he's not involved in this sort of, this battle between two sort of chains. And it's just, it just sort of showed the aggressive nature of the expansion plans. And I think I referred to it in the book, it's not dissimilar to the way Starbucks did it with, you know, your local cafe. They came in at both ends of the street, so it was just became a matter of convenience to go to Starbucks, even if you understood and preferred the business of the place that was there before. You know, it was convenience, it was nice, it was new, it was probably, to be honest, a slightly better service as well. So they were quite quick in taking over, and then ultimately so successful that, you know, some of the British brands who sort of overextended in Ireland were looking to find their level, started selling back to Paddy Power, back to an Irish firm in Paddy Power. Carl sold shops that they had bought off independents to Irish ones. And, you know, it was pretty remarkable business story. And I don't think it was really told a lot at the time because bookmaking wasn't qu- quite, you know, it wasn't covered as a real business story a lot of the time. It was just covered in the racing pages, and every paper had a racing page and a punters platform or whatever where people could write in. But it was just, it was a pretty remarkable expansion, and it sort of foretold how the online expansion would go as well, you know, 20, 30 years later.
Yeah, and we'll come to that in a second. I mean, just briefly again on the land-based stuff, because there's this thing where I think the marketing of Paddy Power is one of the things that people will really zoom in on, because it's so defined. Like, they have a style, they've stuck to that style almost from day one, you know, the kind of cheeky chappy, you know the odds on the Pope, you know, being signed for Glasgow Rangers, and many, many others, the Oscar Pistorius trial, and on and on and on. You have many great examples in the book around that side of things. And their marketing and branding, like, I could drive through any town in Ireland and I would clock a Paddy Power shop just out of the corner of my, but the shade of green that they use, which coincidentally is also used in Tony's book, Tony 10, I think, and might also be in your book. Particular shade of green. Yeah, that's subtle genius level stuff. You know, make sure all the stores are look identical, have them in prominent positions, even at this stage in the game where the move is gradually, well, much more towards online. But that thing of, and Tony would have started off like many people, you know, betting in bookie shops and then moved online, and we would see that a lot in our work with people as well. And of course, for generations, people have been getting into serious trouble, you know, in bookie shops, you know, or tote betting at the racetrack, but probably not anywhere near the level that we're talking about with online. And you kind of touch on some of the nudges and the manipulations and the data mining that they use in that. Okay, so we're going to set the stage. Paddy Power, there's this battle for dominance on land-based. Then there's this kind of, you get into the early stage of online, which when you look back at it now, just seems so rinky-dink. I mean, I was joking before we hit record here today that this is like my childhood vision of Star Trek. You know, we can talk to each other from three different locations, you know, on video, you know, and maybe, you know, to my mind, that kind of early stage online gambling with Paddy Power and all the other online gambling operators was so rinky-dink compared to now that it's kind of laughable, you know, the technology that was there and how basic it was. And you tell the story about, you know, the internet cable going, you know, over the roof into the shed in Tala, and, you know, how the online department, you know, there's only a couple of people in it, and how, you know, kind of hamster generated power or whatever. Could you tell us a little bit about how they got into online and how they started moving things into that space?
Well, they weren't early adopters, Paddy Power, despite being quite successful at it. They had previously attempted with various things to get either online or on phones or on televisions, of finding some way of, you know, convenience, as we talked about with the location of shops, of being with the customer wherever they were. But obviously the internet was the first, you know, successful attempt at that. And they followed, you know, I think it was William Hill had launched theirs around the 1998 World Cup, and it hadn't really worked because it was a new thing and people didn't really quite understand what they were trying to do with it. And like at the time, you know, basically we're told that the internet, you know, while useful for three or four trusted websites, other than that, it was sort of a scam. And Jesus, don't ever give your credit card details to anyone over the internet and things like that. But Paddy Power had sort of cracked telephone betting, you know, before that. So they had a client base who wanted to gamble away from bookmakers' shops. So they knew there was a business model for them. If you can reach those customers, they'll bet with you. So they took the decision to launch a website. And, you know, they got very intelligent people to do that, younger people than elsewhere in the company, people from outside the bookmaking world, which, you know, caused a bit of surprise at the time. And there was a lot of distrust of hiring guys from with university degrees who had never, maybe even never placed a bet before. Like, a lot of people say that applying for Paddy Power was the first time they bought the Racing Post, they read it on the bus on the way out, you know, that this wasn't, it wasn't, just hiring a lot of bookies and seeing what happened. It was hiring a lot of sort of people with some sort of technological or computer science aptitude and letting them away at it. And they, you know, they tried and failed, and they got Nick Leeson, the Barings banker, to launch it. So they used their marketing power. They knew who they were going after. And they were going after sort of people who maybe didn't go to bookies. You know, that was the great untapped customer base. It was, you know, these are the guys who don't want to go into bookies. And they just tried to offer them some version of betting, you know. And they found that, you know, a lot of the bets in the early days were on golf. So they realized, okay, this is probably the sort of character who doesn't really want to go to the bookies, you know, he doesn't want to be seen in and out of the bookies. He wants to go to the golf, you know. So they tapped into a customer base that wasn't available to them otherwise.
And like, what kind of year was that? Because I mean, I'm just going to line up Tony in a second.
That was 2000 into 2001 when they started looking at it. So it was very much the new millennium, you know, and we'll go with this. But it didn't really settle down, I would say, until 2003, 2004, that it became, you know, it started fulfilling its purpose and realizing there was a lot more you could do, and that people who bet online bet on different things to people who bet in shops. And I don't just mean betting on golf versus betting on horses. I mean, betting on yellow cards in a football match, you know, that was sort of unheard of. And the people who developed that were like, what sort of person is going to think that there's care or be excited by the prospect of winning 15 euro off a 5 euro bet on three yellow cards in the second half, or what's going on? But they found that anytime they built something, the customers used it if it was promoted in the right way on the website. And they're kind of like, okay, we are controlling what the customers do here. They're not telling us, oh, we want to bet on yellow cards. They're being offered a market and then taking it up to a degree to make it liquid, to make it worthwhile. And I think that was the real purpose of the internet, is that you could get people to bet on what the companies wanted you to bet on, not what you as a customer might have wanted to bet on.
Yeah, and I think we would see that in our work as well, that people will experiment with different markets. If they have success with it, they'll start thinking, oh, well, this is the market for me because I have some aptitude here. I have some skill set around it. If it's goals scored or over-unders or whatever, you know, there's such a long list of markets in play at the moment, and it's ever expanding as the gambling companies come up with new versions of it. And that people will try that, and whatever clicks in terms of early success, then we'll stick to that. So like that, yellow cards, number of corners in a game, now it's down to numbers of corners in the first 15 minutes. And, you know, there's so many sub-markets within the crazy markets in the first place. And like that, yeah, if you build it, they will come, the kind of mentality. And it costs the bookies little or nothing to create those markets and see what happens, right? And promote them a little bit on the website and push them out and you know, send out a free bet or two on them. So, okay, so that was 2003, 2004. I mean, Tony, when did you open your first Paddy Power account online?
February 2003 was when I opened it up. And at that stage, I suppose, I still had my Nokia 3210. So if I wasn't gambling from the comfort of my own bedroom on my PC, I was definitely one of those phone-based customers. I was ringing in a lot of bets to the point where I knew my credit card number, 16-digit number off by heart. I was doing it so often, I was just able to ring it up and I'd have to bet on very, very quickly. So I definitely, it was set up for the likes of myself who was probably working and liked to have a bet on, you know, was new sports run, whether it was horse racing. And even I remember accessing the internet, their site on my Nokia 3210. It would take minutes to load up, but you could still see the prices of horses. And then you'd fly out to the toilet during work and ring in the bet. And then you go back in and check and keep refreshing your account. It was very tedious, but I used to be doing it between customers. I'd have the phone underneath the counter and you'd be doing it, whereas nowadays you could do it in seconds. It was probably taking me minutes to do it, but it still very much sucked me in. And then, like I always say, that when I opened my online accounts and when I, you know, associate my MBNA credit card with it, that changed everything, because I was able to place bets on any of these markets. And it was like my solicitor, when he was during the court case, always referred to the website as like, it's like a candy shop to a child. I went in and said, wow, I can do all this. And you do get drawn in a lot more and very quickly. And when reading the book, I was really blown away about I suppose a couple of things happened when I was reading the early chapters of the book. I was very much like, I remember when I was interviewed by the Irish Independent when the book was coming out. I remember, I think it was Sarah O'Connor, Brendan O'Connor's wife. I think Sarah is her name. I'm not 100% sure. I remember she said that she went through a range of emotions while reading the book. You know, 1 minute she'd be ironing. She'd be wanting to throw the iron against the wall, or next minute she'd be on my side, and next minute she'd be shouting at me to stop. And very much when I was reading the book, I was left with that. I was kind of like a woman. I was kind of saying, geez, this is brilliant. This, how to build this and push the British out and use the marketing techniques, and especially with Stuart Kenny, how he drove, you know, the business model forward. But then you're kind of saying he drove it forward, but absolutely obliterated everyone on his path. And I think the one thing that really kind of resonated with me was the whole story with the FOBTs. And like, I was kind of saying, yeah, the campaign did not have them over here, but yet they had the maximum amount. I think it was 500 in your quote in the book, the maximum amount of them over in the UK. And we're still seeing that today, whereas the bookmakers, and even it's been online the last couple of days with people, you know, Adrian Weckler talking about, you know, Live Vet and all this, like with the credit cards, that's still happening today. Like we're talking years on that, you know, they'll do one thing over in Ireland and they'll do one thing in the UK because they have to do in the UK, but they won't do it over here. And that's the bit that really boils my blood in it. And that's what I was left with kind of reading the early chapters. But definitely to go back to the original question, Barry, the online was 2003. And that brought me into a different level of gambling, but also a different level of potential harm as well.
I mean, Aaron, when you were talking to people, obviously you spoke to a lot of, I suppose, former Paddy Power employees. And I suppose Betfair would be in there as well, because what started out as Paddy Power, then they merged with Betfair, and you know, they've taken on, merged and or, you know, bought over many, many other companies over the years, including ones across Europe and Sportsbet in Australia, and FanDuel is the one in the States, isn't it? And you know, this ever-growing expansion. So I mean, what is now Flutter has all grown out of Paddy Power, I suppose you might say. But when you were talking to people, the kind of former employees, do you think any of them had any clue at the time if they were letting a genie out of the bottle, or were they just kind of excited about new ways of doing business?
It's hard to know at the time, because everyone does look at it with hindsight, but a few people sort of made telling remarks of when they saw the data from different products, and it would be quite raw data. It wouldn't be, you know, like you'd have from sort of you'd have nowadays, where it'd be analyzed before you saw it by, you know, a computer system. It would just be an Excel sheet of a load of names, the numbers and things. And it still largely operates off that in some ways, but it's more processed now. When they saw the data from certain products that were being deemed successful products because they were making a lot of money off them, you know, someone remarked to me that, you know, there was a lot of areas where you were wondering how the people who lived in them had access to such big amounts to gamble. So, you know, it's a very imprecise interpretation, and it's anecdotal, but it was a sense of, oh, something's happening here that perhaps shouldn't be. There's some misery attached to the success of this product. But largely, and I suppose it was a bit like when I was covering the book, or it was when I was reporting for the book, it's very hard not to be taken in by the innovation and success of these people. And what they were trying to do was create new products and be innovative and win customers. And when you're in that world, if you're doing that, you're successful. And if there's this little thing over here where there might be, you know, you're aware that there's problem gambling or money laundering or whatever it is, you know, that's a side issue. That's not you're fulfilling your main goal. And again, you know, there's been gambling addiction since gambling existed. So they were always aware that there was addiction within the customer base. And, you know, that would have been quite clear to people in shops, in the same way as publicans know who the problem drinkers are and things like that. It was what you did about it. Like, and do you have any responsibility for it? You know, and I think being online certainly reduced that the perception that there was any responsibility for it, because you were no longer Tony O'Reilly, the guy who works up the road. You were just Tony 10. You were just an account. You were just, you know, you were just a data point in a spreadsheet. So let's try and maximize one of those numbers, and that's the profit we make off that account. And they didn't really have anything in place until after Tony was sentenced to really address it. And even Fintan Drury, who was chairman for Paddy Power, has said recently that when he was there in the 2000s, there was just no sort of self-reflection on what this industry was doing by going online. But when you speak to those guys who were there in the bricks and mortar days, when it was about expanding retail networks, who stayed in the industry through the growth of online, I find that they're generally the guys with the greatest misgivings about we didn't do right by people at that crossover point, that we should have built in some safeguards. But then, you know, is that just hindsight? It probably is, because there was just such a sense of excitement of, we can do this online. We can get, you know, we don't have to deal with tens of thousands of customers. We could potentially be dealing with millions of customers. You know, it was the sort of the unconquered country. There's all this opportunity there, and no one really stopped to think of the cost of pursuing it, because none of the rivals were. You know, it wasn't as if, you know, Ladbrokes was really good or William Hill was really good and protective and had all these things in before. You know, no one mentioned it. It was just kind of keep going and see what happens.
I suppose just quickly come in there, like having just recently and finally watched The Social Dilemma, It's very much the same kind of mindset. Even Barry saying, putting the genie come out of the bottle, like even just watching it, like I think someone commented at the end of that, like, we can't put the genie back into the bottle now. It's out there. And it really reminded me of, like, a lot of the people who were interviewed for that documentary were saying that, like, you know, they were part of this innovation and excited to create this product that could connect people and, you know, use it for all good. But then looking back, they were saying they never kind of realized, well, they started to realize that it wasn't all good, that there was this, you know, there was this kind of social knock-on effect as well. And I think that's what we are starting to see, or probably seen for a long time, with the gambling as well. It gives us all these markets, the internet and online gives us all these different opportunities to bet on everything. But I think for a cohort of people, it gives people with problems the opportunity to bet even more and get even more trouble, especially online. Because I will always say, in any of the interviews I've done or any of the, when I'm talking about my own gambling journey, it was the online aspect, the in-play betting, and gambling with credit. They were the three things, and the ease of access, the three things that accelerated my addiction for something that was probably problematic, at risk, very heavy, to very quickly into disordered gambling. And like even talking to clients along the way, like I've talked to so many people over the last year or two that their gambling was at an okay level before or pre-COVID. And then when they went online and maybe had a little bit extra money, and the ability to switch between sports betting and online casino betting when the sports were not on as much, or when they weren't on at all, I suppose, and how that accelerated really, really quickly to the point where they got addicted in the space of a couple of months. Like mine was a slow process, a very definite pattern to it. But what we're seeing, I'm sure Barry will agree, is that people are getting addicted a lot quicker than maybe I did 10 years ago, or maybe someone did even before that, or even when people were gambling in the bookies or on the race courses. It was a slower process because, I don't know, maybe it's more tangible or something, but it was definitely different. And I'm feeling that now we have the opportunity within the regulation coming in to maybe, you know, stem that tide. But as we're seeing with the industry, they don't seem to have the will to do it over here yet, where they could be doing a lot more, I suppose, before this regulation comes in. And that's what I'm finding with clients that we're seeing.
Like, I think that one of the people I interviewed with the book I found most interesting was Matt Gaskell, who works in this area of addiction, basically saying that they've effectively turned live sports into a casino game with all these in-play bets. And that doing that, you know, there's quite strong evidence that doing that continuous betting, rather than placing a bet before an event, watching it for 2 hours and then collecting or not collecting your winning bets, allowing people to bet all the time continuously with no interruption, like as in a casino, does exacerbate tendencies towards problem gambling or disordered gambling, and does speed up the process that might have taken 10 years into a much shorter period, because it's given you all the little dopamine hits of, we're simple enough creatures at the end of the day, and those little dopamine hits from, spinning wheels and bright lights and flashing numbers, it just gives you more of that, and then you become more dependent on it, and you also become more, I think, distracted from what you're really doing, which is betting money. You're actually just, you think you're just clicking buttons or whatever, but you're betting money, and you're causing yourself, harm in a way that you might not otherwise if some of these markets were a little bit less sticky in keeping you gambling. Like, I mean, when I was doing the book, I've never bet in an online casino for fun ever. It just never appealed to me. But I had a look. I thought, for the book, I should know what all these products are. And you can bet from the casino in your Paddy Power app. You don't need a separate app or anything, although I think there is a separate app still if you just want to do casinos. But you play an online slot game and you bet, say, a euro, and then it spins and it's exciting and it looks nice. It looks like sort of Candy Crush or one of these games. And then it spins up 80 cent at you. So in your brain, and I'm considering myself a somewhat intelligent person, I would think that mean that I've won 80 in my account now because I've won, but actually I've lost 20 cent, and they've presented it as an exciting win. And, you can just see that's a psychologist's sort of experiment of, can we make this poor ape think that it's won something when it's actually lost? And, like, when you start seeing all those little triggers, you can understand a lot more that they know a lot more about their customers and their customers' behavior, and they can nudge it and trigger certain responses in quite a scary way, I think. It is rewiring the brain.
Yeah, just come in. Sorry, Barry, just coming quickly on that, you're probably going to make the same point, as the losses disguise the wins. But the bit I found about the book as well is the point you made about when you're watching a match and you're betting maybe down, to keep you engaged by, maybe giving an offer on, as you said, Eric Cantona to score the last goal. So you'll get your money back if he scores the last goal. So they're keeping you engaged online in the actual app, just to maybe try get a little bit more money out as well, with the opportunity that you're thinking of. But if Canton does score the last goal, at least I get my money back on it.
Yeah.
Sorry, Barry, you were going to come in there on something as well.
Yeah, no, it's a similar point about the losses disguised as wins. And we've had Matt Gaskell on the podcast, so anybody who's interested, to go back to season one. I think we had Matt on fairly early on, and we spoke about that very subject. And look, I mean, it's funny. I mean, people might have watched The Social Dilemma on Netflix, and they mentioned B.F. Skinner, the famous behavioral psychologist researcher, in that, and all of the behavioral tricks that we see in things like social media, which come from things like slot machines. But when B.F. Skinner was trying to explain his famous experiments with rats and pigeons to the general public, he said, it's kind of like a slot machine, right? Because slot machines existed before B.F. Skinner started doing his behavioral experiments, which means that the geniuses who invented slot machines knew a lot more about human behavior than B.F. Skinner did before B.F. Skinner did, right? And there's a reason why, if you go to, Vegas, there's no windows. They pump the rooms full of oxygen to keep you alert. They give you alcohol to mess with your impulse control. These guys have been at this for a long time. They're astute observers of human behavior, right? And you don't have to reinvent the wheel. This is fairly old stuff. The slot machine goes back quite a while, and the trickery around is, keeping the person engaged, keeping them distracted, keeping them focused on the betting. And that thing of, like, the normal trajectory going back a little while, not too far, for a person with a gambling problem, so they start out sports betting. It could be golf, could be a football accumulator that spreads over the whole weekend. So it could be days or at least hours before you know the outcome of your bet. And then maybe that's not doing it for you anymore. So you might bet on individual football games, and then maybe you move on to horses, dogs. That's not doing it for you anymore. Then maybe it's virtuals in between the horse races. And then maybe you're going on to roulette because, you can't get enough of a fix. Normal trajectory of any addiction, tolerance increasing, and withdrawal, more intense withdrawal when you're not engaging in it. And then the end of the line will be something like slot machines, where it's just bang, 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 you're getting hit after hit just to feel normal. That's the trajectory for it. So long gaps between the bets, you know, low frequency up to very, very high frequency, right? But this new thing with making sports betting like a slot machine gets people straight away into high frequency, right? That's, they're not doing that by accident, right? They're not, that's not an accidental thing that they've stumbled across. Like, that's by design. You have a chapter in the book called Addiction by Design where you look at a lot of this stuff. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, like, because you mentioned, I think you mentioned, you certainly mentioned in the book, the Vanguard Project. Was that something that, that was a direct result of Tony's case, or certainly was it around that time?
It wasn't. It was around the time. It was just after Tony's case when they started getting all that flack from the average person. It was kind of like, what, like, how can you say you didn't know what was happening here? And like, there was already sort of a sense in the industry by the end of the first decade of the 2000s that they were going to have to do something to address publicly that there was an addiction issue, that, you know, they were going to have to start touting something like responsible gambling, or, you know, when the fun stops, stop. You know, they knew that there was something they were going to have to do, but they were quite reluctant to really be to do it. So, you know, there was no first mover's advantage there, really. You know, you weren't going to make any money by restricting your most profitable customers, or and there was also the sense that, well, there was quite intense competition between the bookies for these customers. So everything was designed about around retaining them and getting more money out of them. So it would have been counterintuitive to do anything about it, you know, as an addiction issue. But then obviously after Tony's case, you know, I think that was just a real, real rude awakening for Paddy Power as a company, and everyone, you know, right down to the risk managers and traders I spoke to, you know, they were aware of this account and they were fascinated by it. But, you know, some of them, like, it sounds naive now, but they were like, but we didn't, you know, we didn't think he had a problem. We thought he just like might've inherited the money. And you're kind of like, but if he inherited the money, why would that be less of a problem? It's, it was just a really, really kind of perverse way of thinking about it of, well, if he's not stealing it, it's not a problem, because there's no such thing as, you know, gambling addiction unless the person's stealing. You know, it's just a bizarre notion. But then after that, they did the Vanguard Project, where they got Professor Darren Vensky over from McGill University to look at what Tony was talking about there, the lifetime of a problem gambler, and when they went from being a potential problem gambler into having, you know, a problem. And if you could design a way of spotting that and then interacting with the person at that point, or as close to that point as possible, and trying to get them to address their behavior. But really, you know, it was, to use the example of alcohol a lot, because the industry likes to, you know, liken itself to alcohol, because everyone can kind of, or, you know, most people can relate to having a couple of drinks too many, and sure, what harm really, you know, maybe a hangover, but it's not like that. I don't see the links between gambling and alcohol in terms of how they're regulated are, you know, they're changing a lot. You can see governments don't want to treat it like alcohol. They think that it's a more dangerous thing for the people who have problems. But I think with the Vanguard Project, there was some acceptance that the industry needed to take action itself, and Paddy Power needed to take action. And, you know, they did some analysis, which was quite useful at the time, where they found that about 15 to 20% of the profits on certain products were coming from people who would have flagged these problem gambling alerts that they were going to set up. And that really shocked people in there, because the study that they had done, or the analysis that they had done, had borne out what they believed it would in terms of the level of addiction within their customer base, that it'd be about 1%. And that's what it found. But it found that they were generating vast sums of profits from those accounts, or from those people. And that sort of gave a bit of pause for thought. But again, like, I think something I tried to get across in the book was that, you know, when you have these companies with no regulation, and it's full of really bright and innovative people, they think they can solve all their own problems by being, you know, sure, what's a politician going to tell us about our customers? We know what we'll do. But obviously, when you're doing that, you're, you know, it's completely counterintuitive. You're a company, you're trying to generate profits and increase the value of your shares. Why would you go after your most profitable customers and say, here, please don't bet with us anymore, actually seek help? The imperatives for doing that just aren't really there unless there's strict regulation and fines and you're held to account externally. And you see that across all industries, from the people who make cladding that go in apartment blocks to, you know, tobacco manufacturers. You need an external regulator that's very strict when you're dealing with a product with any sort of social risk in it at all.
Absolutely. And I always remind people, you know, we work for a charity. The charity sector has a regulator.
Yeah. Right?
Now, obviously, on occasion, some bad and unscrupulous things happen within the charity sector. So it is only right and proper that the charity sector has a regulator, right? But we don't sell addictive products, right? Yeah. We don't make vast amounts of money from flogging addictive products to people who we know to be addicted to those products, and we don't incentivize people to stay addicted to addictive products, right? That sector has no regulator still, right? There are regulators for anything and everything bar the gambling industry in Ireland. I mean, you spoke about, you know, the I don't buy the naivety thing with Tony's case. I mean, in the last 6 months before Tony was caught taking money from Unpust, I think he lodged, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Tony, in the region of 1.4 million euros in cash over the counters of two Paddy Power shops in his last 6 months, right? At 1.7 million in total. But the people tend to ignore the fact that the last 6 months it was 1.4 million, which is, you'd imagine in any walk of life, that would raise a flag. I mean, I would often make it at the point that Tony, as a post office manager, would have to raise a flag for money laundering if somebody came into the post office to do a Western Union transfer for how much, Tony?
It was 500 euro. We flagged one before. It was a particular customer who was sending over 500 euro to Spain every week, or maybe twice a week, and we flagged it.
500 euro for money laundering in the post office that Tony worked in. Meanwhile, Tony's lodging 1.4 million in cash over the counters of two Paddy Power shops. And people naively thought, well, you know, he could have inherited it. If you've inherited millions, do you go to the bother of withdrawing it from your bank in cash, then walking down to your local Paddy Power shop, lodging it over the counter in cash, only to be put onto your online account, right? Nobody's that naive. Like, I would put it to you, I'm not criticizing you here, Aaron, like, obviously, but I don't buy that for a second.
See, but the thing is, the naivety comes from the fact that you've analyzed all of those things, whereas what they were doing was sitting in an office and going, brilliant, he's after having 10 grand on this market where we've only got 10 euro on it. You know, and I write in the book about how they got a risk manager to work on a later shift to suit Tony's betting because he was so profitable. So there wasn't a sense, you know, they knew there was something up here and they were just trying to square it away in their own consciousness by saying, oh, maybe he inherited it, or, you know, maybe he's gambling for someone, you know. But obviously he wasn't gambling for someone, because they could see then, and I spoke to someone who would have been looking at Tony's account on an almost daily basis, they could see he was chasing losses. The accumulators he was putting together were to reach an amount that was getting bigger every time the accumulator fell over. They were, you know, right in the book that they had to take. So the risk managers or the traders, you know, would be sort of graded on their books or their markets over a week or a month or whatever they were being reviewed. And they had to take Tony's betting out of it, because he could make or break someone, make them look like the genius of the year or the idiot of the year, depending on how his bets had gone. So they had to take him out. You know, that shows that there was a certain level of customer who had to be treated differently. But why didn't anyone make the change to, well, how do we treat them differently? What do we need to do? And, you know, do we need to give them tickets to the Europa League final? Or do we need to ring them and say, you know, you might have a problem here. Would you like to be put in touch with whoever? And how those interventions might have gone. But, you know, the modus operandi at the time was keep this guy betting, keep all of these guys betting, don't let them go over to Ladbrokes or whoever else. You know, it's a guarded secret of he's our cash cow. You know, that's the way it was.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I don't know, I can't remember if you draw the parallel, but I know that you do look in detail at, I think I have this correct, because I know we live in a very litigious and country with defamation laws. A certain very high-profile member of the criminal fraternity in Ireland making very, very large bets in a Paddy Power shop, and I think Stuart Kenny had to intervene because it was pretty obvious that the guy was laundering the proceeds of crime. So they could intervene there around money laundering because it was pretty obvious that it was money laundering. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that was John Gilligan, who is a notorious criminal in Ireland. And his way of laundering money was to go around bookies' shops and to send runners around bookies' shops. And on some occasions, apparently back every horse in a race, because it didn't, you know, as long as you returned something, it was a lot cheaper than traditional means of money laundering. And basically, it was known in the industry that this guy was who he was and he was doing what he was doing. But I mean, it was increasing turnover in shops and on markets that otherwise wouldn't have had big bets on them. So he was sort of allowed at it, and there was no obligation at the time. And even I think at the time of Tony, I don't think there was any obligation on bookies to do any money laundering assessments in Ireland. Some of them may have done on a case-by-case basis, you know, just maybe on the tip of a policeman or something, but it wasn't part of the industry's regulation or responsibilities, which is just really strange considering it's known since, you know, the beginning of time that gambling is a way of laundering money because you've got receipts, you know, and we still see it, you know, in the Criminal Assets Bureau here when they seize, you know, Rolexes and flights to Dubai and things like that. There'll often be a bet slip for a big amount on a short price favorite or something. And now they have brought in regulation of, I think, €2,000. If you collect more than €2,000, you have to show ID and things like that. But it is just, it's still one of those areas where you kind of go, how did people not know that this industry is in specific need of very close attention from a regulator?
Yeah, I would recommend anyone who has the opportunity to read the book, because the details of that thing with John Gilligan are just mind-blowing. And there's also the Dennis Rodman story, which I don't think we'll have time to get into today, but that is just so bizarre. And there are so many interesting aspects to it, not just from, say, a gambling addiction perspective, but just how this thing came from kind of a very kind of small place at a time where gambling really was a niche thing. And, you know, we're major players, I would put it to you, in getting the genie out of the bottle, democratizing or popularizing gambling across a much broader demographic, you know, for good or bad. That's not, well, I suppose it, from my perspective, is for bad, because the more people who gamble, just from a percentage perspective, the more people are going to develop gambling problems. But, you know, there's that very, very interesting trajectory just to look at, you know, this massive change where we haven't had those kind of changes in alcohol. We haven't had those kind of changes in illicit drugs. You know, heroin has been heroin for a very long time. Crack cocaine has been around for a very long time, as is cocaine, cannabis, all these other things. Alcohol hasn't changed in any meaningful way since the year dot. But we've had this game changer in, you know, first of all, they kind of popularized it more, even back when it was bricks and mortar, you know, who shot JR, all that sort of stuff. Then online, as Declan Lynch often says, was the rocket fuel. It's just bang, you get this thing that was already pretty addictive and you give it a rocket fuel, and then a smartphone is like rocket fuel on the rocket fuel. You know? Yeah. And it's so interesting to look at that and all the other stories within it. Just before we finish up today, there's one thing that I was hoping you might be able to explain, and Tony might have some other questions as well, if we're okay for time. But future expected margin. Can you explain to people what that means?
That was the equation that Paddy Power put accounts through, particularly horse racing accounts, after a small number of bets or the amount turned over on the account, which predicted how much money they would make off you in the long run. So I have a training manual or slides from a training day that the risk managers were given about future expected margin. And it showed, you know, they'd done an analysis of, I think, about 10,000 of their customers, a random sampling. And it showed that some would give 30% of everything they bet to Paddy Power, was, you know, the higher end of the scale. Most were in the sort of the 15 to 20%, which is goes against Paddy Power's sort of marketing spin at the time, which was that we just want to take, I think, a euro for every 10 of your bet, you bet, and you get the enjoyment factor out of that. They're taking slightly more than that in this sampling of customer bases. But then at the other end of the scale, which is the minus percentages, so you're taking money off Paddy Power, that just halts at about 5%, minus 5%. So if you're winning about 5% of your bets, you're gone. You're just restricted. They don't want you as a customer. You can lose as much as you want. You can give them 30% of everything you bet, no problem. But if you win about 5%, you were gone, because they determined that if you were doing that over a certain period, they needed to restrict your account. And, you know, it's the tale of the professional punters and the sort of the clever horse racing guys, is that once you have a decent run on horse racing or greyhound racing in particular, they'll just restrict your account, because they've determined that if they let you keep at it, you won't be one of the losers that they want in their customer base. So for me, it was actually one of the big factors in my reporting on them over the years, was you just have this anomaly that you have a company, or you have companies that are more than willing to step in and stop you from winning in the long run on their products, which are supposed to be you against the bookie, and that's the way they present it. And you can get one over on them, and their marketing is you're getting one over on your pal Paddy Power anytime you bet, or we're giving you a money back special and things like this. That on one hand, they will stop you from winning, but on the other hand, they do, you know, for a long time, did almost nothing to stop you from losing everything, you know. And the in certain cases, you know, the VIP schemes were set up to maximize how much they got from people. And you can see, like, I go through in the book with some of the VIP schemes they have for online casino games, like Turnover Tuesday, because you had to turn over 10 grand or whatever it was, depending on your account, I think £8,000, to meet the criteria to stay in the scheme to get your bonuses. Like, you talk about addiction by design, like addiction by design in terms of the product, but developing things like that on top of the product and promoting them, and being quite frank, I've emails between people who developed addictions and their VIP relationship manager. They're, you know, it's really just, it's so cold the way it's said. Well, like, you know, you've gotten your bonuses, that's it, you know, and if you keep asking for them, we'll have to flag you to RG, which is the responsible gambling team. So, you know, stop asking for them, or else, you know, they're sort of threatening people with intervening with their responsible gambling initiatives. You know, it's cruel in a way, because whatever about, you know, whatever about that level of naivety, however, you know, however true it was around Tony's time, since then, there's no excuses for those sort of interactions with people. And, you know, I'd welcome anyone from any flutter company or any gambling industry to say why they think having something called Turnover Tuesday, where people have to sit in front of their computers betting on casino games until they've turned over £8,000, is part of any responsible gambling initiative, or part of any enjoyment for people, or is a necessary tool to retain customers. Because the argument is that, well, if casinos can comp you free drinks and put you in the presidential suite, well, then why can't we give you a couple of tickets to a sporting event? That's fine. That's an argument to make, but drill down into it. Casinos are also asking people to sit at tables for hours upon hours. Is that the right thing to do? Like, the industry can't, you know, can't on one hand say they're serious about addiction and their social responsibility and they're doing their best and they're trying to balance having a fun product with, you know, obviously the social harm it can cause as well, and have things like Turnover Tuesday and Windfall Wednesday and vast teams of VIP managers interacting with people who should be flagging responsible gambling things. There's another guy in the book who was 24. So he filed, they've recognized finally that people under the age of 25, particularly men, are slightly less risk averse than the general population. So they've started capping their accounts. So this guy was 24 when he started, when he was first made a VIP. And then the April before last, 2020 April, he was losing so much. They said, if you pass on your friends' phone numbers and email accounts, we'll give you, I think, £250 for each person who signs up, and then £500 a month for every month they stay as a VIP. So they had to meet the criteria of being a VIP, which is quite a high turnover. And they're also going to give them a bottle of champagne for everyone that signed up. So, you know, the industry can pretend that a lot of this stuff is historic and it's before we knew all these things, but it's not. They go along with it as long as they get away with it. Then they either get regulated or it gets publicized and they get a bit of flack for it. They have to answer to politicians about it. So they withdraw a product and present it as, oh, we're here to save the industry and God, you know, we're doing everything we can. Tony referred to it there with the credit betting. They're not, you know, it's lip service. They'll say they'll ban credit card betting, but they won't ban any of the loopholes for people to get around it. They say they recognize that, you know, credit card betting is, there's more addiction within that customer base that bets on credit cards. But, you know, that's not new information. That's not something that was discovered, you know, last month. And they're going, oh God, we must deal with this. It's been known for a long time, and they'd have their own analysis and they'd have external and independent analysis of the same thing. And they'd have anecdotal evidence, you know, from the likes of yourselves and other, you know, and in the UK NHS funded groups. And they don't do anything about it until it becomes a PR exercise and a bit of lip service, or it becomes saving face after a big scandal.
Yeah, and like all of that stuff is very grim, and that is the grim reality of it. And we know, like, if anybody kind of follows any of the decisions from the UK Gambling Commission, like, this stuff is happening on an ongoing basis, and it's not just, you know, or companies that you've never heard of. It's the household names who can take a £7 million fine, slap on the wrist, cost of doing business, and keep on trucking. You know, that's the reality of it. Paddy Power Betfair would be in there as well. I don't think they got 7 million. I think that was Betway. But, you know, most of the household names are in there in terms of having received pretty substantial fines from the UK gambling regulator. The same companies are all licensed to operate in Ireland. Who knows what they're doing in Ireland, because nobody is regulating them. One would imagine that they're doing fairly similar things, especially in a market where there's no regulator. You know, there's a possibility they're doing worse things. But, yeah, it's grim, that side of it. Tony, before we let Aaron go, any thoughts or questions?
Yeah, I just probably come in with probably final thoughts on it. I think when Aaron was interviewing me for, you know, the chapter he was writing about my story, he asked me how I felt about the fact that Paddy Power had paid the money back. And at the time I couldn't answer him. I remember I was driving from Waterford to Carlow, and we were kind of chatting as I was driving. I remember I was pulled up outside my dad's house in Carlow. I was kind of going, how do I feel about it? And I didn't know how to feel about it at the time, because I was hit with mixed emotions, because it was something that we kind of knew or we suspected for years, and I kind of heard it off a few people. But it was really when it came out in the Business Post, and I remember reading the article, and I was left. I remember myself and my partner were walking in Tramore that day. We went for a walk, and I was hit with a mix of emotions throughout the whole day. But what I was kind of left with afterwards really was that, you know, like, and I have to thank Aaron for writing the book and for researching it and bringing it out to the public domain, the fact that it was paid back, because the feeling I'm left with really is one of, it makes one of the hardest conversations I have to have in probably the next year or two when I'm telling my daughter around, you know, the fact that I stole money, a large amount of money, and went to prison. It makes that conversation a little bit easier, because it's them taking a bit of responsibility. Now, they've never come out and said it, which I would love. I said in the book, I accept the failings in my case, because at that time, responsible gambling wasn't a huge part of any business model within the industry. But I would love them to come out and say, yeah, we got this wrong. And I know Stuart Kenny has said that to me, and I accept that fully. And I was happy that he did say that to me, but I'd like the organization to come out and say, yeah, we got this wrong. But in them paying back the money shows that they're taking that bit of responsibility, that they got it wrong. Because I was, you know, obviously in the height of addiction, I couldn't make those informed choices, and I should have been protected as a vulnerable person at that time. I take full responsibility for everything I've done, and still do. But the one thing I'm left with, it makes that conversation a little bit easier. And that's a conversation I've been dreading to have for the last 10 years. And it's the last bit of the kind of jigsaw as such in my recovery, is having that conversation and being able to move on past that with my daughter, knowing, I think she does know bits of it, but when I'm having that conversation, for me to be able to say, yes, I done this, but this money was paid back, which kind of does take a little bit off my shoulders, I think, as well. So for that, I have to thank you, because it makes a conversation for me very, you know, a little bit easier. And just for, in general, for writing the book, because I think it's an amazing piece of work, because it highlights, you know, both sides of the coin. It highlights the fact that, you know, this is a huge business that's, you know, developed out of, in, you know, small beginnings. And it really is an Irish success story in lots of ways. But also the fallout of that is something that we really need to look at. And at a time when there seems to be, the tide seems to be turning, and there are a lot more conversations around gambling addiction, disorder gambling, because we've been banging on for this for 10 years. You've been doing it for the last 7 or 8 years, Aaron. Declan's been doing it for years. It seems to be that, you know, it's been written about a lot more regularly. Governments are, you know, they're promising to make really big changes in the next couple of years, which is brilliant. And, you know, I can rest easy then, because, you know, we've been putting ourselves out there for so long trying to, you know, get a little bit of change. And I think the book has really added to that conversation, which I think is really, really important. But on a personal level, for me, how I feel about it is I feel a little bit of relief for a conversation that has to happen in the next year or two.
That's great. Just on the fact that they don't take responsibility for a lot of these, like in one of the chapters in the book, I sort of show that after every big scandal or big fine, they say, oh, this is historic and a lot has changed in the last few years. And they're doing that up to the Tony Parente case last year, the year before. And then I show there's another one, you know, it's just, they've been able to set the narrative for so long of, oh God, you know, that we accepted, we have failings, but that was a long time ago. I mean, even in response to the book, the day the book came out, they issued a note to all their customer facing staff saying, if you get any questions on the book, this is what you should say. And it was, you know, while we accept it, we haven't always, you know, done right by safer gambling. And you're kind of gone, so what does that actually mean? Are you taking responsibility for building this business on the backs of addiction? Or are you just saying that there's a few mistakes made along the way? Like, I mean, I'd love to see them be part of the conversation more, because they're just not at all anymore, which, I mean, is very telling for a company that is as attention seeking as Paddy Power has been for a long time. They're just not part of the conversation. And anytime we've tried to have sort of discussions in Ireland around it, be it on, you know, broadcast media or whatever, you know, they don't put anyone forward. And it's very difficult then to get a view on what the industry actually thinks about. It's just very staged press releases and, you know, safer gambling code, you know, in an effort at self-regulation, which has been going on since time began, is that you try and self-regulate before the real regulation comes in, because you think that the real regulation will just ape your self-regulation and you'll get away with whatever you want to get away with. But I think the likes of yourselves pushing that conversation forward has held them to account in a way that they just weren't before. Like, they were just allowed to do whatever they wanted.
Yeah, and, you know, I think certainly I've debated lots of empty chairs on Irish radio over the years, where in the one hand, it's kind of, you would think it's an advantage, you know, to be kind of shooting into an empty net. But it would be much, much more meaningful to have a meaningful debate with representatives of the gambling industry. Like, I've been on the same show in the same segment a couple of times as representatives from the Irish Bookmakers Association, but they've insisted that we're not debating one another. So the person in question will say their piece, then it goes to me, they're off air, and I say my piece. There's no, like, they will absolutely resist any form of back and forth where you can actually get into it and unpack some of this stuff, because they know they really don't have a leg to stand on. As you know, you've mentioned historical issues, blah, blah, blah. My arse, you know, we see these new cases, worse cases propping up every day of the week. There's nothing historical going on there. I mean, I briefly before we finish up, I mean, I do a bit of consultancy work for a Danish company that makes an artificial intelligence, kind of like that Vanguard project thing. They're trying to plug it into online gambling operators, scan the data, you know, then they'll send some data sets out to people like me who know a little bit about gambling addiction and say, look, look at this 3-month window of this player's profile. It's all anonymized and score it, you know, with 100 being the most harmful it could be on that scale, right? And you look at some of these data sets. I'm looking at an American one at the moment. America has just opened up to sports betting. And already this stuff is off the charts. You're looking at people, you know, gambling for 36 hours straight, you know, in these massive binges where they're losing tens of thousands of dollars. People who would gamble 90 days out of 90 for 12, 16 hour stints at a time. Already, like from day one in America, like this stuff is, it's going to be carnage over there. We know that it's already carnage here with, and in the UK where they have a regulator, like it's, we need some major, major changes there. And like Tony pointed out, I mean, that disclosure, if you'd be able to put in print, because we've been hearing that rumor for years that Paddy Power had repaid the money that Tony had stolen from On Post. Obviously, Paddy Power don't want to come out and confirm that, I would imagine, because it might set a legal precedent for other people, because there are many, many, many people in similar situations to Tony's whose employers might be very happy to get the money back. They probably don't want to set a legal precedent for that. But that was, I think that was a really important piece of journalism to get that in print on the record. And I imagine your publisher's lawyers might have to have a really close look at that one before that went to print. But no, the book is absolutely amazing. And obviously my interest in the gambling industry is, you know, helping people who are affected by gambling addiction, whether it's individuals themselves or family members, and then trying to do the preventative piece, as Tony does most of that work. He's up in a school in Leitrim, or he was there from yesterday. And to do the advocacy bit and the lobbying and try and do something about this. But it is fascinating, and it is, you know, a success story, absolutely. You know, the Paddy Power thing, and that they rode the crest of that technological wave and were, you know, innovators in it and have kind of gotten onto the world stage. Now, what they do with all that power is up to them. But I would hope, if any of them are tuning into this, have a think, folks, about what you're doing, especially, you know, here obviously is our main focus, but those poor people in the United States of America have not got a clue what they're getting themselves into, and that could be absolute carnage over there, like already early warning signs. So please, if you're listening to this, anybody who is a decision maker at any point in time, have a think about what you're doing. Aaron, thanks so much. I can't recommend the book strongly enough to anyone listening there. Even if you know, if you're not based in Ireland, I think you'll find this fascinating, because Paddy Power, aka Flutter, have their fingers in pies in the US, I think in Canada as well, all across Europe, Australia, the UK, you name it. That Flutter brand is so expansive, and they're coming to a place near you very soon. Be sure of that. So please do check out the book Punters: How Paddy Power Bet Billions and Changed Gambling Forever by Aaron Rogan. It's available in all good bookstores and online, and also on Audible. Aaron, thanks a million, and thanks as well, not just for the book, because I mean, we've been talking to you for years. You're one of the main people kind of leading out stories around gambling addiction, gambling regulation, what some of the dodgy stuff that the gambling industry gets up to. And yeah, we really appreciate that. So keep up the great work. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, lads.
Take care.
The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.